Actually, it's very interesting that you made reference to Rabbi Nataf, because he's the one who chose my topic. So,
that shows his broadness.
And I was quite intrigued to find out what I was going to say as well, after I found out about the topic. I think that actually the most difficult part of the title is actually New Vistas. Because old vistas we are theoretically familiar with. But perhaps we'll get to some new insights today. But I want to start right away. When one does speak about Kabbalah, and to a lesser extent one speaks about Midrash, one has to be quite careful. In fact, today we're familiar when people speak of Kabbalah, the masses at least, more likely they're speaking about some kind of, at best, pseudo-Kabbalah, and at worst, they're speaking about something which is completely divorced from anything which is Jewish. When people speak of Midrash, when people quote Midrash, also, more often than not, people are not looking to try to delve into the words of the Midrash and find out or figure out what the Midrash really wants to communicate. More often than not, what we find are people using Midrashim in order to anchor a particular idea. And I simply challenge you to go back and to look how Midrashim are used in most rabbinic sources, and it's more of an anchor than as an honest attempt to figure out what is it that Chazal want to teach us. Rather, they find that it's some kind of a hint or an allusion, or as I said, it strengthens even what their particular idea is. And I would go so far as to say, therefore, there are two types of those who comment on Midrash, although commentaries are not all that popular. There are many sources that cite Midrash, and they cite them in one of two ways. One, trying to really figure out what the Midrash says, and the second way is trying to find support for what they want to say. When we speak of Midrash as Parshanut, we speak about Kabbalah as Parshanut, I find it would be most fitting to start with a citation from the Sefer HaZohar. And those of you who don't know, because there are many Jews, many educated Jews, many learned Jews, who've never had the opportunity to even open up the book, the Zohar. The Zohar itself is a commentary on the Chumash. There's no doubt that the Zohar is written on various levels. And when I quote it today, I'm not looking to understand the deeper levels of it. But the Zohar can absolutely be used as a perush as well, just as any other midrash can be used, for the insight that it shares on the verses themselves. And for example, when we get to this destruction in the city of Sodom, one of the things that's interesting, God and Avram have this negotiation. They start at 50, go to 45, go to 40, 30, 20, and finally they stop at 10. Why does Avram give up at 10? So all of you remember Rashi. Rashi says that it needs at least a minyan to save the city. The Zohar says the pshat in the pasuk, and it says this as pshat, is that Noah thought that there were 10 and thought that he won. Because he thought that he won, so therefore he stopped. I'm not going to ask you to judge what makes more sense, Rashi's or the Zohar's interpretation, but at least you'd have to admit that the Zohar's understanding or reading of this is really quite compelling. Because Avram does not sound like the type of person who will back down in this particular negotiation. This passage is found in the Midrash HaNe'elam, the Zohar Parshat Bahalotcha, Daf Kuf Nun Bet. And those of you looking for a commentary on it, aside from the Sulam, which is on the spot, I would suggest that you look in the Maharal, who does not quote the Zohar all that often, but over here he quotes the entire passage in the 13th chapter of the Tiferet Yisrael. Omer Rav Shimon Vayla Hahu Bar Nashta Omer Tahoraita Atta La'achza'a Sipurin Bi'alma Umilin Dehedyoti. Woe unto the people who think that the purpose of the Torah is to tell us stories and tell us things which are plain. And he goes on to say, the Zohar goes on to say, if that's the case, we can write the Torah today as well. There are good authors today, there are creative authors today. The Zohar ever explains that every single word of the Torah contains within it secrets, profound secrets, And it goes on to say that the words of the Torah could be compared to a body, to a goof. And every goof has a neshama. And every neshama is the essence of the individual. And therefore, anyone who looks at the Chumash and all that they're concerned about is the pshat, or what we sometimes call the simple pshat, the Zohar accuses that person of being very far from the reality of the Torah. In fact, it goes a little bit further, and it claims that the mitzvot of the Torah are really the guf, but the soul is the idea behind it. This idea has been repeated by various Hasidic masters, and sometimes in a dangerous fashion. Anybody who's familiar with the teachings of Ishbitz, later on the teachings of Rav Tzaddok, will know that sometimes one can even get to quite antinomian conclusions based upon this particular passage. Because if the Torah has a soul, and the Torah has a body, then why deal with the body if you can deal with the soul? In fact, let's just take a particular example, which, again, these same commentaries deal with. We've all been taught from a very young age that Avraham kept the entire Torah. Although the truth is, if any of us were a little bit more careful, we would know, it never says that he kept them, it says Mekayim. Avraham was Mekayim. What does it mean to be Mekayim the Torah? So on one level I can say, take it literally, that means that Avraham on Pesach sat and had matzah, and you will find rabbinic teachings that say that. Avraham on Shavuot, did he eat cheesecake? Did he dance on Simchat Torah? Did he get drunk on Purim? So of course you will find those who will want to take all of these teachings literally. What's interesting, specifically within the Hasidic context, specifically within the teachings of Ishbitz, and as I said, of Tzaddik, but also Lev Yitzchak Berditchev, others, you'll find a very different approach. It doesn't mean that Avraham performed all of the mitzvot. He was mekayem the mitzvot. What's the difference between kiyum ha-mitzvah and performance of the mitzvah? So it goes back to our teaching. The Torah has a body and the Torah has a soul. The body reflects what it says in the Torah. The soul reflects to what is actually accomplished by performing the mitzvah. Which means when an individual does a mitzvah, their soul is uplifted. When a person performs a mitzvah, their soul is transformed. But the Torah too has a soul, and therefore an individual like Avraham, who had a profound sense of nature and a profound sense of Torah, but not on our level, Avraham was able to elevate his soul in 613 ways at least, but not through the performance of the mitzvot. That's why this is antinomian. That's why this is dangerous. Because we can all be sure that there will be individuals who say, I'm like Avraham. I don't need the actual performance of the mitzvot because I can connect directly to the soul. And by the way, don't think for a second that this was not part of the conflict between Chassidut and between what today is known as the Litvish world, or more specifically at the time the Gaon from Vilna, or later on Rav Chaim Volozhin. Anybody who can say that the Zmanei Tfilah are no longer important, because it's really the inner feeling which is more important, you can understand how that comes out of this idea. But nonetheless, let's not ignore what the Zohar itself says. And as I said, the Maharal goes and spends an entire chapter on this idea. The Torah itself has rules, the Torah has stories, and the Torah has a very deep soul behind it. The deep soul is not always found in the words themselves. The deep soul is found, the levush is the more obvious, but the neshama is found in the words of Torah Shebaal Peh. It's found, as far as the Zohar is concerned, within the mystical tradition. It's found in the words of Midrash. And woe unto the individual whose entire understanding of Torah is based exclusively upon the written word and has no understanding whatsoever of our tradition. The Zohar, as I said, and I'm not going to read the entire passage, has some very negative things to say about such a person. Everything I've said till now, I say by way of introduction. Obviously, we want to try to get into the neshama and understand the levush. And in order to do that, what we're going to speak about today is about levush. And levush that we're going to speak about, being that today is Hanukkah, will somehow be connected to Hanukkah. On the other hand, being that the part of the Torah that we're reading right now deals with the Yaakov trilogy, as sometimes it's called, or the Yosef episodes, we will deal with those parshiot as well. And as much as we can, within the time allotted us, try to bring as many of these things together. And to try to show what exactly is the levush, and what exactly is the neshama behind it. It is quite significant that the very beginning of the story of Hanukkah, which of course could be found back in Sefer Bereshit, after Noah leaves the ark, Noah suffers some post-traumatic stress. Noah becomes completely drunk. The Torah describes as follows: V'yachal Noach ish ha'adama v'yitak karem, v'yesht min hayayin v'yishkar v'yitgal betoch ohala. V'yar cham avik na'an et ervat aviv v'yaged l'shnei echav b'chutz. One of his sons, Cham, sees his father's nakedness, and he tells his brothers. Chazal understand that there's something far worse than just seeing his nakedness. The reason for this is quite simple. If I'll skip two verses, it says, Vayikatz Noach, he woke up, or he regained his senses from his drunkenness. Vayida asher asalo b'no hakatan, and he knew what his son had done to him. Chazal tell us that some kind of horrific things may have taken place, ranging from that his son raped him to castration. It is interesting, by the way, if you read through Sefer Bereshit, virtually every single male after this story that does not behave properly is a descendant of Ham. Just go all the way through. Francis is looking at me. You can go from Paro, who takes Sarah, through Avimelech, Shechem, all the way through, the men that don't behave properly, the men who are impulsive, the men who take the women that they want, which, by the way, reminds us of the generation which existed prior to the flood, and there's no question that this is a continuation of that generation. All of this comes through Ham. But we're told about two other brothers who focus our attention much more. V'yikach Shem v'yefet et hasimla. Shem and Yefet. The first one is Shem. And of course we know that Shem is the father of all Semitic peoples. And Yefet. Yefet is the father of Greece. Shem and Yefet, with Shem leading the way, they take together et hasimla. They take together a garment, clothing. V'yasimu al Shechem Shnehim, they put it on the shoulders of the two of them. V'yechu acharonit, and they walk in backwards. V'yachasu et ervat avihem, u'pneim acharonit ve'ervat avihem lo'ra'av. They display much better behavior. The two of them go in and they cover up their father. Afterwards, Noach, who on no occasion do we find actually speaks to his children, curses his son, v'yomer arur knan, or his grandson, v'yomer arur knan eved avadim yele echav, v'yomer baruch Hashem Elokei Shem, v'yiknan eved lamo, yaft Elokim layefet, v'yishkon ba'ole Shem, v'yiknan eved lamo. Over here we see blessings which go both to Shem and to Yefet. It is certainly significant that the Shem Havaya, the Yudke Vovke, gives the blessing to Shem, while the Shem Elokim gives the blessing to Yefet. But we also find one more thing of incredible significance, and that is the term Vayishkon, which of course has as its roots the Shekhinah, Shekhen, makes its first appearance in the Torah in this instance. The elements that we see here are a blessing for two. We see a curse for one line, we see a blessing for two lines. And we're even told an incredible vision about how two of these, Yefet and Shem, are supposed to somehow join together. And the place of the joining together is to be in Ohalei Shem, in the tents of Shem. Of course, those of us who know the story of Hanukkah, the descendants of Yefet, the Greeks, who do have a sense of the aesthetics, the yofi, of beauty, instead of finding beauty of the Shekhinah in the Beit HaMikdash, they decide instead to defile the Makom Shekhinah. Which means this particular blessing, which is given in this context, does not come to fruition during the time of Hanukkah. In fact, we find the opposite. We find the debasing behavior, which perhaps is more associated with Cham, manifesting in the people who are associated with Yefet. But I want to focus on something. Let us make no mistake about this. Till modern times, when I say modern times, the last 200 years or so, the Jews have never had an opposition like they did during the time of the Greeks. Till this point in time, the competition had always been Jews against pagans. And as the Gemara tells us, the attraction to paganism was always the attraction to the base. It was an attraction to physical behavior, to Gilui Arayot. The Greek world gave something else. It gave Chochmat Yevanit. It gave a wisdom. It had a philosophy. Which means the Jew who was looking to leave Judaism would have to lie to himself in order to embrace paganism. But to embrace the Greek world, the lie did not have to be as big. This was the first time we had competition, and we did not have a competition on this level till the Enlightenment again. All the other times, it was a completely different level. But the Gemara tells us something fascinating. The Gemara in Megillah and Daf Tet, and it's echoed by the Midrash in a couple of places, including the opening chapter of the Midrash in Sefer Devarim, tells us that the Torah should not be translated into other languages. The only language that it can be translated into is Greek. A Torah could be written in Greek. The mezuzah tefillin can't, but a Torah could. And that's what it says in Midrash. Eilu Dvarim, Adam Yisrael, Mahu Shehe Mutar Lo Lechtov Sefer Torah Bechol Lashon, Kach Shanu Chachamim, Ein Bein Sfarim Letfilin Umezuzot, Ela Shesfarim Nechtevim Bechol Lashon, Rabbi Gamliel Omer Afasrim Lo Hitir Lecheyechtivu, Ela Yevanit. Oh my time, and what's the reason? It goes back and it quotes our verse. The idea of the Shekhinah, the tents of shame and the Shekhinah going together, Yavan or Yeft, dwelling in the tents of shame, are understood to be that even the Torah can be translated, but not the mezuzah and not tefillin. Tefillin is probably a whole separate lecture to be given about that, which we won't go into today. But according to Rav Nachum of Breslov, it is related to this bizarre gzeirah that the Greeks made to write on Keren Shor, Ein lechem chelek b'elokei Yisrael. What in the world does that mean, that the Jews had to write on the Keren Shor? So Rav Nachman notes, it says Keren, not Krenayim. Keren means one, and not two. And he goes, a shore with one Keren is what you would call a unicorn. The unicorn is related back to the Korban that Adam brought, which is why there's no more unicorns left. But the unicorn also, on a visual level, is related to the tefillin. because a keren is called a tefillin as well. And therefore, a Jew wearing tefillin is associated with this idea. The tefillin has to be written in Hebrew. The mezuzah also must be written in Hebrew. And it's interesting that we have a tradition which is not written in the Gemara, but is found in the writings of the She'iltot of Rav Chaigon. The Gemara tells us that when you light your Hanukkah candles, you have the mezuzah on one side and you have the Hanukkah candles on the other side. And Rav Chaigon adds, and then you have the person lighting them wearing tzitzit in the middle. Where did the tzitzit come from? The Midrash tells us that tzitzit is the reward that Shem got for covering up his father. So what did Yavan get? What did Yeft get? It says he got clothing of substance, clothing of honor, which means they both received a present in clothing for the use of clothing, but who was the one who initiated? It was Shem. Shem therefore receives the mitzvah of tzitzit. So it's interesting that again, these elements of Hanukkah candles, the elements of the mezuzah and of the tzitzit, all come together at the very dawn of history and will later on echo in the future. Let me make an observation. On all of the holidays, from Rosh Chodesh up, there are various laws and customs regarding how to dress. Right? All of you know that on Shabbat, there's a special thing called Shabbat clothing. All of you should know that on Chag, there's a special thing called clothing for Chag, which should be nicer than Shabbat clothing. There's a special clothing which is called clothing for Chol HaMoed, which, if we'll be honest, our community has somehow forgotten. The clothing, what is the definition? And I say this as a rabbi, what is the definition of Chol HaMoed clothing? Neither Chol nor Chag, someplace in the middle. That's the definition. I don't know if you have special clothing, but there are laws written about this. Regarding Rosh Chodesh, even Rosh Chodesh, it's Rosh Chodesh tomorrow, told him that the Vilna Gaon would wear his Shabbos hat on Rosh Chodesh. I think you could be medayek that he didn't wear all of his Shabbos clothing, there's just Shabbos hat, that something should be different. If you have a special Shabbat kippah, perhaps that's what the Vilna Gaon wore. Comes to Hanukkah, when it comes to Purim, by the way, there's issues of dressing up on Purim, but more importantly, the Shulchan Aruch reads, you should wear Shabbat clothing on Purim. Hanukkah, there's no reference to clothing. So maybe it's 8 days and it's too long, but that's not a good answer. Maybe because it's not really a holiday, but by Purim you have to. It's still not a good answer. So I said it's interesting that Shem from the very beginning does take the clothing, does take this simla. Nonetheless, on Hanukkah we don't use the clothing. There may be a very profound reason to this. But let's push that aside and return back to what we're up to in this week's parsha. Well, this week we find Yosef dressed up. Safnat Paneach. Yosef is dressed up, he's hidden. Actually, everyone who sees him does not know who he is. No one recognizes him. The Egyptians don't know who he really is, and certainly his brothers don't know who he really is. But from the very beginning of the story of Yosef, you have more reference to clothing than any other parsha in the Chumash. If you look in Parshat Vayeshev, you have, of course, the Ketonet Pasim, the coat of many colors. Later on, the brothers will take off that clothing. Reuven will come back to the pit and rip his clothing. They'll take Yosef's coat, they'll dip it in the blood and give it to their father. Tamar will take off her widow's garments and put on other clothing. She'll cover herself with a veil. She asks for Yehuda's cloak. Later on, when Yosef goes into the house of Potiphar, his clothing, her clothing is grabbed, his clothing is grabbed. You find clothing throughout this parsha. Clothes are given, shed, ripped. And if you didn't pay attention, you don't even notice it. I guess unless you're involved in the clothing industry, you don't realize that clothing is a major theme. But even as a theme, it doesn't seem to be the most important element, with the possible exception of the Ketonet Pasim. That's a major issue. But it's within our appreciation of the clothing or of the lavush. We'll get to a much deeper understanding of this entire episode. Let's start with the beginning. And first we'll do very simple parshanut that nobody can argue with. What is the significance of the ketonet pasim? So what's the first thing you need to do? You need to check for other usages of ketonet pasim. Ketonet pasim is used one other time in Tanakh. Where is that? Where? In the story of Tamar and Amnon, which is very interesting, because over here it's used to represent the potential fratricide that almost took place, where brother killed brother, or at least thought about it, spoke about it. In the end, Yehuda's cynical comment, and I read it as cynical, with apologies to the Netziv, what are we going to gain from killing him but sell him, make some money, ma betza, what are you going to gain from it? Until the sale takes place, these clothing becomes a symbol of the hatred that took place, of the jealousy that existed in the family. And jealousy is incredibly wrapped up with the personality of Yosef. In fact, Yosef in Gematria comes out to be kin'ah, jealousy, and that seems to be the whole relationship is one of incredible jealousy. And the reason is they don't understand Yosef, and if I have time, I'll come back to that as well. Yosef is hidden. Yosef is hidden, and Yosef is very much like his mother. His mother is also hidden. The image of Rachel's high point of hiding under the bed when she gives up her husband for her sister encapsulates, according to Chazal and certainly the mystical tradition, something incredible about Rachel. The Zohar speaks of the beauty of Sarah and continues the beauty of Rachel is what is hidden, because that is the beauty of a Jewish woman. The beauty is that which is covered. But by Leah, it speaks about her eyes, which were soft. I know you generally don't think of Leah as being beautiful, but the Targum does speak of her being beautiful. Rabbi Soloveitchik once said, he said this in 1955, and he was quoting someone, I don't know who he was quoting, because I heard the tape in Yiddish, and he liked this parish a lot. He said that the beauty of Leah was her eyes, but her eyes, she used to cry. The beauty of Leah was that she used to cry. He said, the beauty of a Jewish woman is her ability to pray. And Leah's beauty was her tefillot. That was the beauty of Leah. But nonetheless, the beauty is something by Leah which is outward, and the Malchut of Yehuda is something which will be outward. The Malchut of Yosef, which takes after Rachel, is something which will be hidden. Something which is covered up. Something which is not seen by everyone. But of course, it's clothing that end up hiding things, and Yaakov gave Yosef his clothing. And before we get back to the Ketonet Pasim, and before we get back to the story of Amnon and Tamar, let's recognize another thing. Yaakov had some very interesting episodes with clothing as well, where Yaakov dressed up in clothing that was not his. And that caused problems within his own life. There's even a midrash that claims the clothing that Yaakov gave to Yosef was the clothing that he took from Esav, which maybe you find a little disturbing. Let me ask you another question. Ketonet pasim, what are they made out of? So you say you don't know. If you looked at Rashi, you would know. What are they made of? They're made out of karpas, which means? Let me put it this way. What could they not have been made of? Okay, that's a hard question. The odds are they were not made out of linen. Why? A bunch of city folk, I say. Because color is not absorbed by linen. You would have a very hard time making linen into many colors. Wool would absorb different colors. There are midrashim that indicate very strongly that the Ketonet Pasim was made out of wool and linen together. Ketonet Pasim, the Ketonet is made out of linen and the Pasim are made out of wool. and the wool and the linen will therefore be woven together in order to create the ketonet basim. We see this when the Midrash tells us about the bigadim of the Kohen Gadol and about what it brings kapara for. You see the reference over there, it quotes the ketonet pasim when it speaks about it bringing kapara for hatred and perhaps even for bloodshed, the Midrash and Shirashim adds. But as I said, that's on a deeper level. That's on a Midrashic level. With Amnon and Tamar, why was Tamar wearing ketonet pasim? Shat in Pasuk in Navi, because it was considered to be clothing of royalty. The Ramban says it right over here in Bereishit. It's clothing of royalty, which means that what Yaakov Avinu understood was that Yosef would be royalty. For us, however, it's far more interesting, because Ketonet Pasim represents, it only comes in two different stories, where, and I'll say this as an understatement, where siblings don't get along, or certainly don't get along properly. If there is a worse relationship in Tanakh than Yosef and his brothers, then it's Amnon and Tamar. And I'm not going to here choose which is worse. They're both completely horrific. The rape, where a brother rapes his sister, goes beyond description. Where brothers try to kill a brother, goes beyond description. This being the case, Ketonet Pasim don't sound all that wonderful. However, this wool and linen may go back together to something which is far earlier. The Medrash Tanchuma, where it speaks about Cain and Hevel, alerts us to an incredible insight. So again, let's remember, what did Cain do for a living and what did Hevel do for a living? One worked the land and the other was a farmer. The other was a shepherd. Cain is the one who works the land. What did he bring? He brought flax. Over here, the Midrash tells us the Isur of Tzemer Upishtin goes back to the very first time that siblings don't get together, that siblings don't get along. It goes back to the very first time that a brother stands up and kills another brother. The Vilna Gaon in his commentary to the Zohar tells us that the murder of Hevel required more Kedushah in the world, and it required this mitzvah of shatnez. But let me explain this on a, perhaps in a way that we can understand this. You were to ask the average Jew in the street, what is the most famous verse in the entire Torah? What would they tell you? I'm taking a guess here. Which? Love your neighbor as yourself. There are some Jews in the street who don't realize it's written in the Chumash. They think it's only in the New Testament, unfortunately, but indeed it's there. In the 19th chapter of Vayikra, we have a string of interpersonal relationships which are written, talks about not robbing, not stealing, not delaying pay, not cursing someone even if he's deaf, not putting a stumbling block in front of someone who's blind. And I've imagined, forgive me for this, I've imagined, you know, when God is up in heaven and he's teaching the Torah, at least the levush of the Torah to the angels, and he tells them this wonderful mitzvah not to curse the deaf. I can imagine all the angels up there clapping politely. And he says not to put a stumbling block in front of the blind, and they clap a little bit louder. And he goes on to say, to judge people, tzedek, not to go and to toch rechilut, not to stand on your neighbor's blood. Finally, the Torah says, not to hate your brother in his heart, which probably the angels appreciated greatly. Rebuke people in your nation. Not to bear a grudge, not to take revenge. And finally, you have the apex. And love your neighbor as yourself. Which probably, as again, my imagination, all the angels with standing and giving the wave and high-fiving one another. This is, but there's a problem with this. What's the problem? How do you continue the Chumash? What do you do for an encore? You just now got, in the 19th chapter of Vayikra, you've gotten to this point of love your neighbor as yourself, so what do you do as an encore? Anybody remember offhand what the encore is? What the next pasuk says? The next pasuk says not to wear shatnez. So maybe you think that this is a coincidence. If you understood the Medrash Tanchuma, you understood the Medrash that I quoted earlier from Shir HaShirim, these things are absolutely related. Kayin can kill Hevel when Kayin thinks that Hevel is expendable. Why would Kayin think that Hevel is expendable? Because all people are the same. People are people are people. People are generic. Kill one, you get another one. And what is God's response? People are not generic. Every single person is special. You kill one person, you've destroyed the whole world, which is learnt out from the murder of Kayin, when Kayin kills Hevel. That's where it learns it from. Which makes the girsah kol ha'olam kol ha'olam and not kol ha'matzil Yisrael unlikely. It's more likely that whoever saves one person, because it's speaking of Kayin and Hevel. Kayin thinks Hevel's expendable. So what does God say? Hevel represents something. Hevel represents wool. Kayin represents pishtan, flax. These are two separate realms. Don't put them together, because if you put them together, one will lose its identity, and if it loses the identity, you will then think that one is expendable. Therefore, the murder of Hevel creates the need for more kedusha. And therefore, the next time you go and you buy clothing and you ask, does it have shatnez? Don't just mechanically ask, does it have shatnez? In your heart, you should accept upon yourself, as the Magen Avraham tells us to do every morning when you're about to start davening, Hareini mekabel atzmi ha-mitzvah taseh shavahaf l'reacha kamocha. That not to wear wool and linen together should not be seen by itself. But that's part of this issue of clothing. When I now realize that the action of Amnon is something which is horrific, and that is not loving his neighbor as himself, that is self-love, that is being narcissistic, it's only caring about himself. When I look at the relationship between Yosef and the brothers, how interesting again, that the ketonet pasim, which now we understand may very well be wool and linen together. But let's go back, because this is not the first time that the ketonet is introduced in the Torah. The first time that you have a ketonet introduced is, of course, going all the way back to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. God helps them get rid of their pathetic covering, and he gives them instead clothing to put on. The yell will be shame. By the way, the Gemara associates the word vayal bishem with busha, lo busha. Prior to being clothed, they had no busha. Vayal bishem, they now need to be clothed because now they have busha, now they have embarrassment. Incidentally, this is not the only pejorative association with clothing. The idea of a me'il, a coat, is associated with the word me'ilah, which is a trespass. And you finally get to the word bigadim. Bigadim are certainly associated. And this may be pshat in the Gemara. There are those who claim it's pshat in the Chumash. The bigdobah are related to bigida. Bigida, and I always search for a good translation of bigida. It's deceit, but it's more than deceit. Yeah, you have a good translation. I'll forget it for next time. Treachery. Clothing represents man's loss of innocence. By the way, I'm not advocating that we find our innocence. couple of years ago, I wrote an essay where I spoke about something about eating meat. I hope there are no vegetarians here who will get too upset with me. But there was an individual who's one of the very vocal people that speak against eating meat, and he wrote me something in terms of Jews and halakha. I won't mention his name, but he wrote me an email saying, "But weren't Adam and Eve vegetarians?" So I responded, "They were also running around the Garden of Eden naked. What is the relevance to their being vegetarian? We no longer live in the Garden of Eden. We live in a different existence. We live in a different place. But the fact that we have to wear levush or me'il or begadim, all of these things point to something which in us which is corrupt, something which in us which is lost, something which in us which seems to be completely gone." It's interesting that what Yaakov gives to Yosef is a ketonet pasim. Later on, Yosef will be entrapped with bigadim. Let's leave that for one moment more. Yosef was incredibly beautiful, which is interesting because he is the first and only character in the Chumash, male character, whose looks are discussed. And the Chumash does know the male character, who it's significant to know what he looked like. Yosef, who may have been perceived as being assimilated, good-looking, and according to the Midrash, cared about his looks, and cared about his hair, and cared about his clothing, Yosef would have been the poster boy for the Hellenists. He would have, and Rav Kook, by the way, gave a very important talk in the last year of his life. And he spoke about this by Sudat Shlishit, by Shabbat Chanukah. He spoke about how we always will read the story of Yosef and his brothers during the time of Hanukkah, because the Hellenists saw Yosef as their role model. The Hellenists saw Yosef as being somebody who assimilated. They saw him as somebody who was beautiful and therefore speaks to their aesthetic sense. Yosef, of course, always remained Yosef HaTzadik. And it was the Tzidkut of Yosef, which I do not believe they understood. When Yosef goes into the room and says that she tries to seduce him, Mrs. Robinson or Potiphar, whatever her name is, tries to seduce him day after day after day. It says that when no one was in, he walks in, which Chazal are not happy with. Chazal are saying, if nobody else is there, why is he walking in? Why put yourself in a situation? And it says that she catches him by his clothing. She catches him by his bigadim. She catches him by his bigida. She catches him by his preparedness to sin. It says at the moment of sinning, and there's two versions of this, the one of the Gemara Sota is that he sees his father's image in the chalon, in the window. I'm sure Freud would have been very pleased with this, the superego, and seeing his father's values and coming right after him. I have a very simple explanation for this. The Midrash tells us that Yosef looked just like his father, which may disturb some of you because you know that Yosef is described as looking just like his mother. So what you'll find is that the Zohar and the Midrash disagree. It says his beauty is the beauty of his mother, but he looks like his father. Beauty, therefore, may be far deeper than skin deep. He has the beauty of his mother, which is something which is hidden, but he looks like his father. I believe that at the moment when Yosef was about to sin and he sees his reflection in the mirror, in the chalon, it looks like his father who's about to sin, and that's what scares him. His father can't sin. And seeing himself looking like his father is what frightens him. Chazal tells us that the beauty of Yaakov was the beauty of Adam HaRishon. The beauty of Adam HaRishon was the beauty before he put on his clothing. It was the beauty before having sin. According to Midrash, when Yaakov goes and takes the clothing of Esav, and he puts on the clothing of Esav, what he's doing at that point is he's putting on the clothing that belonged to Esav, that he took from Nimrod, that he took, eventually went all the way back to Adam HaRishon, after the sin. Which teaches us that Yaakov Avinu had to now live in two different realms. Yaakov beforehand was the man of the tents, a place where the Shekhinah dwelled, and now will have to leave the tents and become a man of the field, which is associated with the curse after leaving the Garden of Eden. Now man has to work the fields. Yaakov had both these clothing, but he put on the clothing. He put on the clothing of Esav, which goes back to the clothing of Adam. And there's even a midrash that that's the clothing that Yaakov gives to Yosef. But Yosef looks like Yaakov. Is it the beauty that he has before the sin? Is that the beauty that allows him to escape sin? When she grabs him by his bigadim, by his treachery, by his willingness to sin, at that moment Yosef does something unbelievable, and he catches himself, he controls his passion, and he runs out of the room. And that's why it's called Yosef HaTzadik, and that's what the Hellenists never understood. They preferred the type of hero who went into the Colosseums, who went into the baths, who went into the places where sin took place. But one thing I can assure you is that this issue of clothing within the story of Yosef is not just a side point. It's something which is absolutely an important element of the story. But I want to move back to Hanukkah for a second. Because all of us know the various stories of Hanukkah. I'm quoting right now from the Nativ Binah because I read this around 15 years ago in the Nativ Binah, even though what I'm about to read you can also find in the Otzer Midrashim. One of the things that it says in the Halacha, and it mentions this in the Gemara as well, is when it comes to Hanukkah, women also are involved in lighting. Sha'av heimayu boto hanes. They were also involved in the miracle. How exactly were women involved in the miracle? So this is the kind of thing that they try to avoid teaching us in elementary school. Because none of the stories are all that appropriate for people who are in elementary school. The more famous one, which is brought, and Rashi quotes this, another Rishonim quote this on the Gemara, it talks about a particular woman who seduces one of the leaders, which is a popular story in rabbinic literature, and then gets him drunk, or perhaps with even milk, and that's why a reason to drink milk, to eat things which are chalavi, and then kills him. There is, however, another story found. I'll just give you the exact citation before you ask me afterwards where I got this from. It's found in the Otzer Midrashim on page 189. It says that the source is Ketav Yad Minkin, Nitpas Pa'otzer Tov, Uvebeit HaMidrash, Chelek Hei. It actually starts off and tells us about all the things the Greeks tried to do, including, and this is very interesting, take away the doors and take away the mezuzah. Not allow us to have doors or doorposts. Which, of course, will then explain why Chazal instituted that the Chanukiah should be lit by the doorpost, which is not all that understood. And I'll try to get to that before we finish as well. Wouldn't it have made more sense that we are supposed to light, just for argument's sake, in the Batei Knesset? Institute that you light in the Beit HaMikdash. You no longer have a Beit HaMikdash, then you light in the Beit HaMikdash. Unless you want to say immediately, Chazal felt in every single home we needed to do something, but there's something deeper going on. Over here, after it tells us about the taking away the doors, it goes on to tell us about this terrible rule that the Greeks had, where basically we're told that the general of the Greeks had first access to any of the brides. Which means a wedding would be celebrated and then the bride would be taken to be with the general and only then returned back to the home. So we're told over here as follows. V'hayu yivanim mit'alalot bibetulot Yisrael v'nahagu b'davor hazeh shalosh shanim v'shmoneh chadashim. For 3 years and 8 months, this took place. Ad sheba ma'aseh shabbat matityahu kohen gadol. Till something happens to the daughter of Matityahu kohen gadol. By the way, I don't know how old this midrash is, but despite what I just now read, it's actually unlikely that Matityahu was ever a kohen gadol. It's in the tefillah you read Matityahu ben Yochanan kohen gadol. Yochanan was a kohen gadol. Nonetheless, it says shenis'et leben chashmonai. She was about to get married to one of the chashmonaim, which is the larger extended family. The Elazar hayashemo. Kevin shigia yom simchata hoshivu b'iparyon. The day of the wedding came. Ukishigia zman ha'seuda nitkabtzu kol gedoli Yisrael l'chavod matityahu uben chashmonai shlo hayu ba'oto ador gedolim mehem. They were the most respected family, the most respected people, and the wedding day takes place. Ukishiyashvu l'sa'od, and when they were sitting to eat, amda Chana bat Matityahu, her name is Chana. She stands up from behind the wedding canopy. She takes her veil and she rips it. She takes her clothing and she rips it. And she stands in front of them naked. Vamda lefnei kol Yisrael kishehi migula ulefnei avia bi'ima v'chotna. I don't suggest any of it that you do this by your weddings, but she's, unless you want to cancel the wedding, but she does this in front of her father, in front of her mother, in front of her in-laws, in front of her groom. Kevin shiru achecha kach, when her brothers saw this, nitbaishu, they got incredibly embarrassed. V'nu panehim bikarka, and they looked down into the ground, v'karu bigdehim, and they ripped their clothing. By the way, it's very interesting how clothing is appearing in this story as well. Of her ripping off her clothing, and then the brothers tearing their clothing. V'amdu aleha laharga, and they stood up, and they were about to kill her. Amru lahem, and she says, Shim'oni achai v'dodai. She goes, my brothers and cousins, listen up. Uma im bishvil sh'amarti lefnei tzadikim aruma belishum avera. And what if I stood up in front of tzadikim, naked, but without any sin? Hare atem mitkanim bi, and now you're jealous of me. But you don't hesitate to give me over to this individual, this heathen, to abuse me. Hello, yesh lachem lomod ni Shimon v'Levi, achedina. Shelo yu elu shnayim v'kanu la'achotam v'hergu. And the Midrash tells us that she continues and she encourages them to get up and to fight. And according to the Midrash, the beginning of the battle of Hanukkah takes place as a result of this wedding. It's so interesting, of Chana standing there naked by her wedding. She's the one who says, are you out of your minds? You have no problem giving me over to this person, but if I take my clothes off in front of you, you go crazy. And they get up and they start to fight for the honor of their sister. That is the story of Hanukkah according to this Midrash. If I had to go back and to try to get to the theme. On the one hand, we saw tzitzit and the mitzvah of tzitzit, the Midrash identifies as being part of that very first episode. You light the candles, you have the mezuzah, which now we realize was attacked on the one hand, and the Hanukkah candle on the other, and the Jew stands in the middle wearing the tzitzit, going all the way back to the story of Shem and Yefet. The story of Hanukkah, and now is not the right time to go into incredible depth in this, one reads the book of Maccabees, one looks at the historical information, where there is not all that much, we learn that at least an element of the story of Hanukkah was a civil war, where the initial battles take place, where Jews fight Jews because Jews were embarrassed about the old tradition, and it was the Hellenized Jews who tried to take over the temple. And other stories that tell us about, including the book of Maccabees, when the first murder takes place or killing takes place,